From coast to coast across America, it's the U.S. Property Podcast with the latest real estate news, interviews, and market trends.
Hey, welcome back to the U.S. Property Podcast as we focus on the very latest real estate property news from around the country. Of course, we do the 50 states, which keeps us pretty busy. Looking at the trends, looking at the forecasts, and of course, so important, the predictions. And you can hear us on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, as well as Amazon. Well, it's been a very busy month. It all sort of kicked off for us with Jeff Grant, the principal broker in San Diego. And Jeff told us about his time on the PGA Tour as a manager before he became involved in real estate. So it's a really interesting chat. We also, in the last 30 days, spoke to Tom Ostasek, a principal broker from Tulsa, Oklahoma. And good morning if you're in Oklahoma this morning. And we find out a little bit through Tom, the Tulsa real estate market. Claire Buckner, the principal broker in DC metro area, she was here and breaking down her market as well as the CITSA versus National Association of Realtors lawsuit. And we spoke to Gene Whipple, a real estate principal working in the Philadelphia property market. So that is all on the way.
We talked to some of the most influential people in the real estate industry, from leading commentators to investors to real estate principals on the U.S. Property Podcast.
Good morning, Craig. Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
So you worked as the operations manager for the PGA Tour, where you manage the on-site operations for its national and international events. Now, real estate is all about being organized and being very well planned, at times months in advance, especially if you are running a real estate company as you are there in San Diego. So tell us a little bit about your time on the PGA Tour.
Yes, thanks for asking. It was a chapter of my life I have found people love talking about a lot more than real estate. It was a job that I just could not have gotten any luckier. I'm so grateful for it, and I will forever be grateful. And when it came time for me to leave, it really was because of the traveling lifestyle. But as you said, I would travel mostly throughout the country, other times parts of the world, to run the on-site operations for the PGA Tour. And it was so much fun. But to be frank, there was a point I hit that I realized I'm not going to be able to live the life I want, both financially and personally, if I'm constantly traveling in the spirit of golf. So I reluctantly resigned. Fast forward now 15 years, I'm now on the host committee of the Farmers Insurance Open, which is San Diego's golf tournament. So it's real fun to connect those dots.
There's a lot of planning going on in terms of what you were doing. How did that sort of help you with running a real estate company there in San Diego? Because there's a lot of things that you can bring from this experience.
Yeah, what a great question. I have never been asked that. And there's really one very loud, obvious similarity or commonality, and that is independence. When you show up to a tournament, I would come in a week in advance and, you know, you must have all your ducks in a row and everything organized. It's the exact same with real estate, whether I'm managing my agents, managing clients, or just creating my task. It's really what you kill is what you eat. It's also one of the reasons I love the sport of golf. Like, take the operations component out, that these athletes, they must perform to make a living. So that's how the players play. That's how we ran the operations. And that's to this day how I run my company. It was a huge benefit for me.
Yeah, the other thing too is that you meet so many people doing a job like the PGA Tour, and real estate is a people's business. You know, it's all about connections. It's all about those relationships. That would have helped you tremendously.
I would say the relationship component has probably been my biggest asset for growth and marketing, is really being focused on those relationships. And as you can imagine, when I left the PGA Tour, there were some cherished relationships I had that I knew were not going to translate over, but I'd committed at that time to, you know, getting on my feet when in the business. And then, of course, getting plugged back into golf via the Farmers Insurance Open. And it has just been so fun because now some of those PGA Tour related relationships are wanting to either buy or sell or rent. Yeah. And sure enough, it's all connecting.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on. Yes, it is daunting to be selling real estate in four different states. The DC and Maryland section of it is pretty simple because they're very, very protective of the consumer, consumer protection states. It gets a little more tricky when you also have Virginia, which is a buyer beware state. To give you a sense, they're all incredibly close proximity, but handled much differently. In DC and Maryland, you can have a residential sales contract that's upwards of 60 pages with all of the consumer protection language and bolded and capitalized text. But conversely, in Virginia, your contract can be 10 pages.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so you've got to be on your toes for sure, covering such a wide area. Now, I want to take you back to October of last year. This was a pivotal October verdict. A jury ruling challenged the practices of major real estate brokerages, including NAR. Are alleging fee inflation collusion. Now, this is what I'm talking about is the CITSA versus National Association of Realtors lawsuit. And this resulted in a judgment. Now, can you explain to the listener, because the crux of this was about manipulation, broader implications about what took place with this case and what is likely to be the result for home buyers and sellers, what they need to sort of take into consideration?
Yeah, it's complex. This was the Missouri case, and they found two main things. One was there was collusion between the NAR and several national brokerages, and I think some smaller ones as well. And then they also brought into question the seller paid commissions for buyer agents. Everything I've read, and this is actually, it's interesting in its absence. Everything I've read has really focused on the seller paid commissions rather than the collusion. I still haven't really read anything that covers in depth what the facts presented were that suggested everyone was colluding. I know the business of real estate inside and out, and I don't know how that could possibly be. It doesn't make sense to me.
Yes, and I think that at the time, you were definitely not alone in your thinking. This has certainly created so much doubt, so many different concerns within the real estate sector from different areas. And what really did throw people in this whole process was the threatening of sellers paying buyer agent commissions.
That's what really rocked everyone. In my opinion, my perspective, I mean, I went to a law school that taught law through economic theory. And, you know, if you look at it from an economic perspective, this case was a micro look into what goes on. So-and-so seller had to pay the commissions for their buyer's agent, and they don't think that's fair, or they felt like they were pushed into it, or what have you. But if you go to a 30,000 foot view, it is the best bad option. If you look at our society and how it functions, if you do not have buyer's agents, you are going to really expose low-income folks, first-time home buyers, senior citizens, all those folks at the margin. Now, of course, a lot of folks will say, well, the buyer will just pay the commission of their own agent. But it's such an expensive process. People are scraping together, well-to-do people are scraping together funds to get a deal done, right? To buy that next house. So it's not very realistic that they're going to pay, you know, 2.5%, 3%, 2% to their agent in addition to all of the other costs they're incurring.
Stay updated in your local real estate market with the latest trends, predictions, and insights. Know your property with the U.S. Property Podcast.
Now, Tulsa, tell us a little bit about it, because it is the second most populated city in Oklahoma after Oklahoma City. The population, I think, around the inner city is 415,000, but the greater area has more population, right?
Yeah, we're probably closer to 1 million people in Greater Tulsa, which includes, you know, the suburbs, the cities around it, Bixby, Jenks, Broken Arrow, Owosso. These are all surrounding cities that make up about 1 million people. And we're second largest in Oklahoma, but those who know that Tulsa is a much prettier, better place to live than Oklahoma City.
Yeah, and why? Why do you think that is? Because you know that there are Oklahoma City people listening right now saying, why? Why is Tulsa better?
Sure, they know why. We have more hills and trees, smaller in the sense that things are closer together. Oklahoma City's a little bit more spread out. Those in Oklahoma just know.
Now, what makes Tulsa unlike any other city across America when it comes to real estate? And what is happening in your local area with regard to property?
Sure. You know, basically across the U.S. and over the last 2023, we saw fewer houses, properties being sold. Oklahoma, Tulsa specifically, we are below the national average as far as home costs. So it's more affordable, the cost of living's lower. And so we also saw a dip in housing purchases, but we're growing in general. And so I'd say just in the first couple weeks of the year, we've already seen an uptick in activity in buyers and sellers.
And what about people migrating from other states into Oklahoma? What has been happening with regard to that, in particular to Tulsa?
Yeah, Tulsa, you know, like I said, I've been here 18 years. I used to live on the West Coast, and I think Oklahoma is just a flyover state. But now, I've love this place, and I've grown to love it. But now I see a lot of people moving to Tulsa, and a few reasons why, again, back to the cost of living. But also, we have incentives for businesses to move here, tax benefits. We have something called the Tulsa Remote Program that incentivizes remote workers to move to Tulsa, and they give them $10,000. We have a city that's growing. I swear our downtown, the skyline's changed. Overall, it's just growing because I think partially because of our politics and our different things that are going on make us much different than the coasts when it comes to all things that go with that.
Yeah, incentivizing companies. I mean, this is a great thing for sort of driving and fueling the real estate market. Is that what you're finding as a result of the local economy?
Yeah. You know, Tulsa was really built on oil and gas, and we still have a big chunk of that here, but most of that has moved to Houston. And so Tulsa really had to figure out who, you know, what business was going to maintain the locals. And really, I describe it as we don't have a lot of headquarters here, but we're a great area for satellite businesses. So the offices of major corporations, because we have low cost of living, yet we have an educated population with several large universities around us. So we're really diversified now in the businesses that are in Tulsa.
Now, I know, Tom, first home buyers, their ears potentially just pricked up when you said the average median house price is $315,000. Perhaps for the audience, what does that buy you, $315,000 in Tulsa in 2024?
Yeah, that would get you a nice 3 to 4 bedroom house, probably 2.5 baths. You know, there's different pockets around Tulsa, but a nice community, good school districts. That's one of the benefits of being in Tulsa.
Yeah, 10 different countries in 1 year. I usually go to at least 2, but we got around in 2023.
And whereabouts did you travel off to?
Oh, my two favorite spots. I went to Dublin, Ireland for the first time, which is a really easy place to get to from Philly. It's a direct flight. And I ended up doing that so I could hop around from there. And I also went to Tangier in Morocco, which was wild. I really enjoyed that one.
And coming back to Dublin, did you travel around Dublin? I've been to Dublin. The hospitality in Dublin is like there's nothing to compare it to.
Yeah, it's really lovely. It's very easy to get around. The public transit's great. We took a train 20 minutes out of town, out of the city, And we were stand-up paddleboarding in the gigantic harbor. And there's big giant seals, and we swam on the 40-foot, which is, I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's just kind of a rocky area with ladders and a changing area, and you jump in the water, and the water's freezing, and everyone around you is really super nice locals. This is just something that they do. It's like almost like an outdoor bathhouse. It's really cool.
All right, so let's find out a little bit about your market and what was happening in 2023, and perhaps some of the suburbs first off, in terms of the suburbs that you are pretty entrenched in and represent. So what are some of those suburbs?
Some of the suburbs nearby, there's a large swath of area called the Main Line, and it's an old school name referring to an old train line that goes through there. But Ardmore, Wayne, Villanova, these areas are Bala Cynwyd, increasing dramatically at a rate of about 5.5% per year. And it's not really a suburban flight from the city. It's just time for a lot of people. And because the suburbs are less dense, there's less homes. We also work in just over the river in New Jersey. This part of New Jersey, some people call it South, some people call it Central New Jersey. That area is increasing at 8% a year for 2023.
Okay, so 2023 had New Jersey up by 8%. What is happening with the first home buyers in your market? Because I understand that there is plenty of activity, and a little bit surprising on just how far up the price point that they are buying.
Yeah, so I cut my teeth on first-time home buyers, you know, going back 20 years ago. This makes me feel really old, but the average price a first-time home buyer would spend is $105,000, $145,000, $175,000. Nowadays, the first-time buyers, I guess they're older, in their 30s rather than in their 20s, but they're spending upwards $350,000, $450,000, sometimes $500,000 and $600,000. That's a lot of money for a first-time home buyer. In Philly, there's a first-time homebuyer grant as well, and there's a few of them. There's a Pennsylvania one as well, and some of them are income-specific, but you can get $10,000 for free, and that's forgiven over 10 years, or you can just get it in general. The Philly First one, that's the one that's more income-limited.
While we can't predict the future of the real estate market, we can provide you with insights on what's currently trending. It's powerful information at your fingertips. From powerful and up-to-date news to professional real estate experts with the latest property trends, know your property with the U.S. Property Podcast.